It's really cool to be back, guys. It was funny. For those of you who don't know, Steve, my husband, and I have just been in Greece for 2.5 weeks, which was really cool. Probably more cool than I realised. I didn't do much research. I was just like, oh, it'd be cool to go to Greece. But I'm a massive history nerd, so I like basically nerded out the whole time because I'd be like, oh my gosh, this is this place. And we were going to Santorini, and I was like, Santorini, it's like a famous place where people go to the beach or something, and everyone gets excited. And then I found out it was ancient Thera, and I was like, oh my gosh. And Steve looked embarrassed while I got really excited. But anyway, we had a really good time, and it was actually really cool. We visited this place called Ancient Marathon, and where the Battle of Marathon happened. It was a really cool place, kids. It was a place where the Athenians beat the Persians, which was really exciting for them because apparently the Persians, who were this massive empire, they apparently had about 1 million troops, or so one historian who liked to exaggerate said, and they came over and they battled the Athenians, who only had a really small troop, but the Athenians won anyway, and it says because they were just so tireless and so dedicated to the cause. And the reason it's called Marathon and the reason we run marathons, just like Josh did the other day, very impressed, a little bit intimidated, the reason we run a 42k marathon is because when they won the battle, they sent a guy back to Athens with the message that they'd won the victory, and he ran 42ks. When you've been to Greece, you realise that's even more impressive because it goes like this, and you're like, 42Ks, total legend. He unfortunately died at the end of it, so glad you didn't. But anyway, really glad. But it was a really cool place, full of history, and we were reading, like, it was like a board there where we're reading about it, and in the end of it, it's talking about the king who sent the troops and a little bit of the other history, and one name jumped out at me, and that was Xerxes. And the reason it jumped out at me is, at the moment, we've been reading through the story of Esther. And Esther was this girl who became queen of the Persian Empire. And she was married to a guy called Xerxes. Suddenly, history meets reality. And I just was really struck by it. Really struck. Sometimes we read the Bible, and particularly stories like Esther that are really allegorical, really sort of seem like a myth, a too good to be true story. And it was amazing to suddenly realize that here is Esther entering into history in real life. Because the Persian Empire was this incredible empire. And you kind of read in the Bible, oh, the Persians, whatever, they were a dodgy people. But you turn up in Greece and you realise this was one of the greatest ancient empires of all time. It was so big, in fact, that when Xerxes, Esther's husband, decided to invade Athens, he built a bridge of boats from Asia Minor to Athens. About 2 kilometres of boats, 2 of them, he built, and he lashed the boats together, put some planks across them, laid earth across it, and for a week his troops marched across. So can you kind of fathom how big this place was? I was trying to wrap my head around it, and I'm like, that is the place that Esther enters into history, that kingdom. And so tonight I kind of wanted to place it in history because I've been trying to think about this over the last couple of weeks, which has been kind of funny, going on a world tour. You don't sort of think what you're going to be doing is thinking about a message to preach, but it was really awesome, actually, because it wasn't random at all that I ended up in those places. I think God really had a purpose and a plan. He really wants to remind us that this stuff is real. It's placed in history. It's not a fabrication. And these are real people. Because I sometimes read a book like Esther, and I get tempted to think, she's not the same as me. Like, yeah, she's got purpose, and I love Rach's message last week, but I'm tempted to kind of go, yeah, okay, she had a grand purpose, but I'm just a mum. I'm just a girl who lives in Toowoomba, and yeah, I've got purpose, I've got value, but that not the same as her. Like, she was on a different level. But I really wanted to talk tonight about the movement that Esther makes from living a life of conventional wisdom to living a life of really unconventional, risky wisdom, and how she got there. Because that's the real woman, that's the real story. So I want to tell a little bit of the story, and then I'll read a little bit of the story. I reckon Esther's is the first real Cinderella story, because here's a girl, she's Evie thinks that's a great joke, so I brought her to laugh. I was like, now laugh when I say this. No, I didn't. So she's born into a people who have been taken over by the Persian Empire. They're pretty insignificant to the Persian Empire. They're basically like third or fourth class citizens in Persia. And her parents die. She becomes an orphan is adopted by her cousin. He brings her up in a pretty cool way. And while she's being brought up, there's some pretty crazy stuff going on in Persia. Xerxes gets pretty annoyed with his wife. She disrespects him in public. So he takes her crown, throws her out, and possibly historians say even murdered her. at that point. So he's a bit of a psycho, and he decides, I know what would be a cool idea. I will create Persia's top model competition to pick my new wife. All the virgins in Persia have to participate, and Esther has to join in this grand pageant, and she wins. She won over everybody that she met with her character. And it's kind of a crazy story. You kind of go, what? Like, what's happening here? Like, why is this little girl being risen up into this incredible position? What's God doing? And in some ways, it seems like that's the success moment of her story. Like, she's reached, she's got power, she's got influence, she's got riches, she's got everything. She's won it all. And at that point in the story, her cousin, Mordecai, he's hanging out in town one day, and one of the greatest officials, well, the greatest official next to the king, is walking along the street, and Mordecai refuses to bow to him, refuses to honour him. And it's a bit of a weird concept for us, the idea of bowing to another guy. But in that culture, people in high official ranks basically decided that they were gods. You walk around museums in Greece and you see a statue of Athena and a statue of Zeus, the god of all gods, and a statue of Nero, the god of Rome, who was just a guy but made himself a god. So they'd create these cults to worship themselves. So that's what this guy was demanding. He was saying, Mordecai, you need to worship me because I'm basically a god. And Mordecai refused, which is cool. We read Daniel a couple months ago, and there that story is about guys who were refusing to bow down, refusing to worship God. So Mordecai makes himself a mortal enemy, and he and the king come up with this idea that we've got to get rid of these people who won't honour us as gods. Because Xerxes probably felt the same way, wanted that kind of honour. We know how he treated his wife before. So they make this decree and say that all of the Israelites are going to be killed. And at this point, the people go into mourning. And Esther hears this from the king, from the king's palace, and she goes to find out what's happening. She gets back this report from Mordecai, we're all going to be killed. We're all going to be killed, and you need to go to the king and beg for our lives. You need to go, you need to do something about this because this is the end for us. And so I want to read a little bit from Esther just now because the Bible says it better than I can overview it. So just give me a sec. I did have to pick like the biggest, heaviest Bible that we own, didn't I? Anyway. So it says, so she's just gotten the review of what's happening, and it says, Hathach, that's the guy who helps her in the castle, went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai said. Then she instructed him to say, all the king's officials and all the people of the provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, and that is that he is put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend his golden scepter and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. When Esther's words were reported back to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Don't think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. Here's the famous line. And who knows that you have, but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this? Then Esther sent her reply to Mordecai. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law, and if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and carried out all her instructions. And on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on the royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance. And when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So she approached, touched the tip, and the king asked, Queen Esther, what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom it will be given you. If it pleases the king, replied Esther, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared. And the reason I tell the story up to that point is I want to talk about what happened to Esther between everybody says I shouldn't go, so I'm not going, to fast for me and I'll go to the king. What happens between her taking the world's wisdom around her, taking the conventional wisdom, look, if I go, everybody says I'll die, so that's probably not a good idea, up to I'm going to go and if I die, I die. Because that's a risky kind of wisdom, isn't it? We don't often have that just kind of decision to make. Well, I don't. But as I thought about it, and I also thought about some other stuff, we were in in Corinth, actually. And we'd just been to Athens and stood in the Areopagus and nerded out again about Paul being there. And it says in Acts, when Paul goes up to Athens, it says, Acts 17, it says, while Paul was waiting, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there, a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. So he's in Athens, he's chatting to all the people, and these are all the greatest minds of history, basically. They talk about the Greek society as being one of the greatest kind of society of minds of all time. From them we get things like democracy, we get things like self-awareness, Socrates saying, know thyself. These guys came up with a lot of stuff that defines who we are. And so he's there and he's reasoning with them, and we sometimes stop at that point and be like, yeah, that's how we should be, hey? That's how we should be reasoning with people, we should be discussing with them. But then the funny thing is, standing in Corinth, we read this. And Corinthians, Paul's just come from Athens, and then he's come from Athens and he's rocked up in Corinth. And Corinth is this pretty crazy place. There's a temple in Corinth that had 1,000 temple prostitutes, so they had some problems. The church there had some pretty crazy problems too. And he turns up, and this is what he says. When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony of God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I suddenly realized he has a movement in his life too. He has a movement from Athens to Corinth. He has a movement from trying to convince people with really clever sounding words to saying, I resolved to know nothing but Christ and him crucified. And I suddenly was really hit with this fact, and that's what I really wanted to talk about tonight, is that somehow in this crazy idea is that the most wise act of all time is God on a cross. The greatest wisdom, the greatest, the smartest, most incredibly beautiful act of wisdom that ever happened was Jesus on a cross, which is a pretty risky move by God, hey, to kill his own son, hoping that we'll love him, hoping or knowing that he can forgive us through that. But it's a risky act. And I was really confronted by that and confronted by realizing that so often I don't choose that kind of risky wisdom. So often I think, just talking to Cole before, so often I think that maturity, a bit like Esther, is going around and asking everyone what the right thing to do is. Going around and getting some advice from everyone. And it just reminded me of a story. Recently, my sister decided she wanted to get married. And my sister has a girlfriend. So this was a bit of a confronting situation for me. And I was kind of like, okay. And then she did something I didn't expect. She asked me if I wanted to be her bridesmaid. And I took a deep breath and said, I'll have to think about that. And lots of you probably heard this story before, but I went away from that situation and I was like pretty freaked out about it, because I'm like, how do I show her that I love her and stay devoted to the things that I say that I believe? And so I went away and I prayed. Actually, I don't think I did pray first, to be honest. I think first I texted three friends, a couple of them are sitting in this room actually, and I said, because Steve was overseas at the time and I couldn't get into contact with him, so he couldn't tell me what the right thing to do was. And so I texted three friends and said, here's the situation, what should I do? One friend said, oh wow, that's easy. Jesus is love, and so you should be her bridesmaid to show her that you're love like Jesus is. Awesome. Second friend, oh, that's easy. Jesus would never do that, because Jesus was really clear about what was right and wrong, and so you'd make a clear stand and not do that. And then the third friend said, wow, I do not envy you. Whatever you do, I will love you and pray for you. Awesome. It wasn't very helpful, Benny. And I ended up thinking, well, great. Clearly I should have texted one friend. No, just kidding. But what was really good is I went away from that like, oh, great. No conventional wisdom can tell me what's the right answer here. Can it? Like there was, and I read blog posts. I probably spent about 4 hours in the middle of the night reading blog posts about what to do if your relation is marrying someone and blah. And it was great. Not. Half of them said obviously this, half of them said obviously that, and then I was just stuck in the middle. And so I prayed about it. Finally, I got to the right place. And I prayed about it and I just cried and I didn't sleep much that night. And the sense that I got in my heart was that I needed to go to her and tell her what I believed and why I believed and express to her how much I loved her and say, look, I can't come to you. I can't be your bridesmaid, because that would be signing a legal document that says that I'm your number one supporter of your marriage, and that wouldn't be true. but I would love to come and I'd love to be part of your day because I love you and I want to show that I love you. And that was terrifying because, and I remember praying and just thinking, I might lose everything because I know my mum and my dad both support her and that's okay. But I basically thought I'll probably lose my family over this because they won't understand. And I don't blame them. Why should they understand? They don't live like this. To them, this is foolishness. This is foolishness to them. Just like Paul says, to people who don't know this is foolishness. And I told my sister, and I can tell you, I was just like heart in my mouth. And she just hugged me and said, you know, I'm disappointed, but I really love you. And thank you so much for being honest. And I was like, okay. And to be honest, it was flooring. But the reason I tell that story is not to be like, oh, you know, how awesome am I? But to be like, honest, how easy is it for us to think we should know the answers or to think that the people around us will know the answers? That wasn't an obvious conclusion for me. You know, it wasn't an obvious conclusion. It wasn't a conventional wisdom conclusion. Because the funny thing is, conventional wisdom doesn't even agree necessarily. It depends on who you talk to, which convention you feel like following at the time. And you can get lost in it, can't you? You know, one person says, oh, give up all your money and go and follow this, and another person says make as much money as you can and give it all away to the poor, and then you're like, oh, there's no right thing. And when I was praying about this, I remember this quote from this guy called Jim Elliot. Jim Elliot was a missionary who went to Ecuador to these people who were extremely violent, extremely violent. And when he went to reach out with them, him and a couple of other guys, they turned up, and before they even got to say anything about Jesus, they all got killed. Four of them. Not a great ending to a story. Pretty big risk, pretty bad payoff. But the cool part about the story is a couple of days later, in the water in the river, they found his journal. And in his journal was written, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. You kind of go, did he still think that after he was dead? But that was what he'd written. And a couple of weeks after he died, his wife, who was back in America, and their three-year-old daughter, they went to Ecuador to reach out to the same people. And through them and through the story of his life, a huge number of people came to know Jesus. Risky wisdom, risky, costly move. And Elizabeth Elliot, one of her most famous quotes is that we don't need to know God's, I can't remember it exactly, but it's basically, we don't need to know everything about God. We just need to know his purpose for us today in this place. Because she didn't know what the outcome of her situation was. In fact, she knew that the risk was high that she'd be killed too, right? Esther didn't know what the outcome of her obeying God was. She knew she might die, right? I didn't know what the outcome of me going to my sister and telling her that I couldn't be her bridesmaid was. But I knew that I had to obey God in the right now. And Esther knew that she had to obey God in the right now, in her today. And I'm just blown away by that, to be honest. I'm blown away by that kind of authentic living. I'm challenged by that kind of authentic living, by that kind of living that doesn't depend on the things in our lives, doesn't depend on the things that we've got in our hand. He is no fool to give up what he cannot keep. We try so hard to keep stuff, don't we? And I'm talking about me. To be honest, I've spent a lot of time crying about this stuff over the last weeks, just realising how hard I hold on to some stuff, hey? How hard I hold on to my life or my kids or my time or my anything, you know, or my failures. If I talk about anything, I hate the idea of failure. I didn't want to get up here tonight because I was so afraid I might say something wrong or you guys might not like me. People-pleasing, I hold on to that so tight, hey? But in that, there's an offer from Jesus that says, you don't need to know the outcome. You don't even need to get it right. In fact, I read a quote this week that says, Jesus expects our failures more than we do and asks us to go anyway. He knows the outcome. How cool is that? We have a God who has the value of hindsight. We read Esther and it's kind of easy to skip over the hard bit and be like, how awesome is she? You know, like she obviously had this amazing strategy. She, you know, asked him to a dinner party and then another dinner party. And in between that, all this cool stuff's happening. You know, Haman's building a big, giant hangman's noose and the king's reading this stuff. But she didn't know any of that. Esther didn't know any of that. All she knew was that she had to go. That's all she knew. and she purposed to know nothing but that. And Paul purposed to know nothing except Christ and him crucified. And Elizabeth Elliot purposed to know nothing, to choose not to focus on the fact that her husband was dead. Holy mackerel. Does that just wreck you? Like, how did that woman pick up her 3-year-old child and go where her husband had just been murdered? Like, oh my word. Because she purposed to know nothing but the fact that God was calling her to something. And I guess Steve was like, give people something practical. And I'm like, sure, honey. I'll try really hard and I'll be rubbish at it, but that'll be all right. But I'm not sure I have anything practical for you. Like, I'm not sure I have, except that I think God has an offer for all of us tonight. I genuinely think that. And I want to do something a bit different. I want to offer you guys the chance to actually pray and come and ask God now. And like, I'll pray for you, and some of the other leaders might come up and pray for you. You know, is there something in your life that's getting in the road of you knowing what you need to purpose today in this place? Because Esther fasted, didn't she? That's the movement. She moves from worldly wisdom and then she fasts. And fasting, I think it's interesting, the book of Esther, God is never mentioned in the book. It's all about the people responding to God. How do people respond to God? And her response is, I need to strip myself of this success, because it's getting in the road of me seeing. I need to take off this royalty. I need to take off this success, because she reached it, hadn't she? She had the pinnacle, like greatest empire of all time, queen of greatest empire of all time, didn't really need anything else. But we're holding on to stuff. And for me, it's I hold on to people pleasing. And this week I had to lay it down. And it's like cutting a piece of yourself off, isn't it? Sometimes it's like cutting a piece of yourself off. But you know what? I feel so much better. And I lost what I couldn't keep, because I can't please you guys. I promise some of you will go home tonight and be like, what the heck just happened? And that's okay, because I don't need to please you. I need to please Jesus. And he's so good to me, so good to me. And so laying down that people pleasing, it's like the best thing I've done in years. So people will ask me about what was good about Greece. And I'll say, I lay down people pleasing. And that might sound funny, but to be honest, somebody asked me a minute ago, what was the best thing? And I feel like I don't even know how to explain it without sounding kind of crazy, sounding foolish. And I read a quote this week by a lady who was a really successful and really rich lady. She was an actual lady in England. And she said, we need more fools in the world, fools for Christ, because fools like this have changed the world. Because actually risky wisdom is foolish in terms of worldly wisdom. It doesn't mean that you don't value and honour worldly wisdom. It doesn't mean that you don't even learn from it. But you don't make it your top priority. You don't hold on to it. Because sometimes you're going to be asked to lay it down. And you know what? It's so much better. The kind of freedom that you gain is so much better. And so I don't mind. I got to the end of my trip at Greece and thought, I wouldn't have minded sitting in a room with no windows finding this out. Because it would have been better than going to Greece and not finding it out, which sounds funny, but so yeah, I just hope that makes sense. But yeah, I just want to offer some time, and maybe Josh, maybe you could come and play a bit. But yeah, just, and look, it doesn't matter if no one comes up or if you all come up. But yeah, like if you want to know that kind of freedom, the kind of freedom that means you can get up in the morning and you don't have to have anxiety about who you are or what you're doing, or you don't have to, if you've got things in your life that you're holding on to and you know you need to lay them down, like come up, let's pray about it. Let's pray for wisdom. Let's pray for a word from God that tells you what his purpose is for you today, because he has one for us, has one for all of us. And isn't that incredible? The God of the universe has a purpose for you and freedom for you. So yeah, let's just pray. Yeah, Lord, I just thank you that you're calling us to the kind of wisdom that we can't manage ourselves. God, you're calling us to live a life of freedom. God, freedom from expectations, freedom from conventional wisdom. God, freedom from even our life. God, freedom from just freedom, Lord. And we want that freedom tonight, God. We want that freedom tonight. We want your wisdom tonight, God. We want your Holy Spirit tonight, God. Thank you that it's walking in the Spirit, God, is risky wisdom, is knowing that your Spirit's leading us in whatever we're doing. And so that's what we ask tonight, God. We ask that we would know your Spirit that's already in us, God. Thank you that we don't have to hope that you're here, God. Thank you that you're already in us, that you dwell in us in fullness, Jesus. And so we just, yeah, open our eyes tonight, God. Open our eyes, Lord.